from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. What will it take to stop the next terror attack against the United States? These days, it might take combing through untold numbers of emails and phone calls. This weekend, the president signed a bill that allows the federal government to continue doing just that. In this hour, we'll explore the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA. It allows what's come to be known as warrantless wiretapping. Should we know more about how much information the government collects on us? Or would doing that take away a key weapon in the fight against terror? We'll explore both sides and take your questions and thoughts on warrantless wiretapping next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. Good morning. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News, sitting in for Michael Krasny. You've probably heard the line from George Orwell's classic novel 1984, "Big Brother is watching you." Since the late 70s, Big Brother has not only been watching, but listening and reading as well, at least in the United States. That's due to a federal law called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA. Back in 2008, the Bush administration got FISA extended to include monitoring phone calls and emails in hopes of collecting intelligence on terrorist plots. This weekend, President Obama signed a 5-year extension of those powers. It all rekindles the debate over what's come to be known as warrantless wiretapping, a digital dragnet that might well include the personal information of ordinary Americans, along with what might be useful intelligence. In this hour of Forum, we'll dive into the debate over FISA and consider how to balance national security with privacy. Joining us to discuss it is Carrie Cordero. She's the Director of National Security Studies at Georgetown University Law Center in Washington. Her background includes work at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, helping develop the amendments to FISA. Professor Cordero, welcome to Forum.
Thank you for having me on. Glad to be with you.
Joining us here in our studio is Lee Tien. He's the senior staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, based here in San Francisco. The foundation has expressed strong privacy concerns over the scope of FISA, and it's suing the National Security Administration right now over warrantless wiretapping. Mr. Tien, good morning.
Thank you.
Professor Cordero, let's begin with you. Give us, for people who are not familiar with this at all, a basic definition of what FISA is and what it allows the government to do.
Sure. Thanks very much. We'll start there. So to start, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act is the nation's law governing, among other things, electronic surveillance and physical search to collect foreign intelligence information. It was originally passed in 1978 to provide a statutory framework and a special court approval called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court for electronic surveillance and physical search authorities inside the United States to collect foreign intelligence information. And originally, when the statute was passed, it included provisions that, based on probable cause that a target is a foreign power or an agent of a foreign power, that individual could be targeted for foreign intelligence collection.
So this basically...
So that's the basic Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act as it was originally passed in 78.
Now, the part that you worked on that went into effect in 2008, describe what powers that adds to FISA.
Right. So there have been a number of amendments to FISA over the years, but a very significant amendment was made in 2008, and that's the FISA Amendments Act. And the FISA Amendments Act did three basic things. First, it recalibrated FISA as it was passed in 1978 so that the United States government and the intelligence community would no longer need to obtain individual court orders from the FISA court to target non-United States persons, so foreigners, who are located outside the United States. And just to expand upon that a little bit, prior to 2008, because of changes to technology, but the way that the law had originally been drafted in a late 1970s framework, the United States government and the intelligence community had come to a place where they actually were having to obtain individual probable cause-based warrants when targeting non-United States persons outside the United States.
And I would imagine this would get very, very cumbersome with the speed with which digital communications move and the volume of email. It probably just became, I'm guessing, a paperwork mountain that became unworkable.
Well, what it was doing is it was diverting intelligence resources in the community, right, to do this process, which was not part of the original contemplation in 1978, because the original statute was intended to allow for an intelligence collection primarily inside the United States to protect privacy and civil liberties. There were two other main parts of the FISA Amendments Act. So it did this first recalibration, and then secondly, it actually enhanced the protections for United States persons. So here we're talking about Americans or resident aliens, no matter where they are in the world. So prior to 2008, if the intelligence community wanted to target for foreign intelligence purposes a United States person outside the United States, they actually could get Attorney General approval to do that. And the FISA Amendments Act of 2008 changed that so that now they have to go to the FISA court.
So to be clear, let me make sure I understand that part. If I'm the one you're targeting, me, and I'm an American citizen, I was born in the U.S., and I am in Paris, let's say, and you want to monitor me for purposes of foreign intelligence, you now have to get permission for that.
Yes. Now it has to be based on – it always had to be based – but it was under executive order. So based on probable cause that the target is an agent of a foreign power. And prior to 2008, the Attorney General could authorize that. And now, post-2008, the government has to go to the FISA court for approval.
Gotcha.
And then the third main provision that came to be with the 2008 amendments is that liability protection was provided to companies that were alleged to have assisted the government in what later became known as the president's terrorist surveillance program.
So these are
those are the three main provisions that the 2008 amendments implemented that then were renewed this past week.
So as for that third provision, just so I understand, if I'm upset that Verizon, for example, was providing the backbone, the infrastructure that allowed the federal government to surveil me, that third provision would kind of would protect Verizon from me being able to sue them and get damages on that basis. Is that right?
Well, there were a number of lawsuits that were filed following the public exposure of what became known as the President's Terrorist Surveillance Program. And when the FISA Amendments Act was passed in 2008, those companies were provided with retroactive liability protection.
Gotcha. That, I believe, is a good segue to bring Lee Tien into this conversation regarding the Electronic Frontier Foundation's role in warrantless wiretapping, FISA, and the FISA Amendments Act. Lee, what would you say is the EFF's primary concern, if you had to boil it down to the one biggest thing about FISA and the FISA Amendments Act that concerns the foundation, what would that be?
Boy, it's hard to reduce it to one, but I'll try. I think the real big question is, how do you have accountability for potential constitutional and statutory violations? How is it? How do we keep the government in line with the law? What the EFF, you know, we sued both the federal government and AT&T in 2000 after the President's Surveillance Program, because we believed that what the original President's Surveillance Program was doing, or the TSP, I guess is what they were calling it, was a violation of all sorts of federal laws, both FISA and the Wiretap Act, as well as the Fourth Amendment. What we found, and of course we have similar concerns over the changes that Professor Cordero has just talked about with the FISA Amendments Act, because that the third part of that legislation killed our lawsuit against AT&T. We were unable to even penetrate whether or not the AT&T had violated the Fourth Amendment or any of the statutes when it gave assistance to the federal government in this warrantless wiretapping. And so what we've got here is almost a continuous pattern from our discovery in 2005 to the present day of a great deal of obfuscation and concealment of what the government is doing under the authority of these laws, whether or not Congress or the courts are being fully informed about what is happening under these laws. And for that matter, the general public, even though there are clearly national security concerns, is really being kept in the dark about what the law even means. There are aspects of one of the amendments that did not get into the FISA Amendments Act in this reauthorization period, for instance, would have forced the government to release FISA court opinions that actually interpret what the FISA Amendment Act means today. And this is a strange situation where we in the general public and lawyers have no way of knowing what the law actually, how the law is being interpreted.
So it's not like when you go through, you know, law journals or law reviews or even just reading opinions. You take it for granted. You can go online and search for the name of a case and you get not only the opinion but all the related materials behind it so you can understand exactly how the court got to its ultimate decision. What you're saying is that the FISA Amendments Act prevents you from getting any of that. You may find out that the court said no, but you don't find out why the court said no.
There is a regime of secret law, in essence, that's going on under this, under FISA and the FISA Amendments Act. And given how complex everything is technologically, it means that we don't know what our own laws mean.
Well, if those of you who are listening wouldn't mind sharing some of your phone calls and emails with us, we would like to make them part of our conversation. Please do call us, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. Hit us up on our Facebook page, facebook.com/kqedforum, or you can tweet us. We are at @kqedforum. I imagine, Lee Tien, that this is one of the more frustrating areas of law that EFF deals with. I mean, EFF deals with privacy issues and in the digital domain on a lot of different fronts, very active in terms of protecting people's ability to know what happens to their data once they hit send, once they hit enter. But in terms of fighting this case, it sounds like one of the more frustrating ones because, as you said, Congress basically passed a law that said, your case is dead. Nice try. You're finished. How do you navigate this? How do you make this work going forward?
With great difficulty. I mean, this is one of the things that we've been saying all along. And it's not just about us in court, right? I mean, this extends to the legislative process. There is a vast sort of cloud or fog of secrecy around these operations. And yet when we are asking, I mean, the whole point of a reauthorization vote, you know, the idea of having sunsets in the bill so that every once in a while it has to come back up and be reapproved, is that, well, we would decide based on the record, based on evidence, is it worth it? Has the government been abusing its power? So forth and so on. And yet, when these things happen, we have examples like Senator Wyden essentially being unable to find out even roughly how many Americans' communications have been collected or received by the government in the exercise of its powers under this warrantless wiretapping program in the FISA Amendments Act, known as Section 702.
Professor Cordero, you were one of the people who has not only brought cases related to FISA requests before the Foreign Intelligence Court, but also you worked on the amendments that were passed in 2008. Talk to me about that process in terms of balancing national security with privacy. When you're thinking about how to give the government the power to stop, and no hyperbole here, to stop the next 9/11, if that is doable through an intercepted email to save the lives of Americans, versus my right to send an email to my friend in London without being caught up unfairly in some dragnet, how do you go about balancing that?
Well, I'd love to pick up, as well, on the oversight and transparency discussion that Mr. Tien was having as well, because it sort of all plays into oversight was a significant part of when the amendments were being considered and passed. The debate over the FISA Amendments Act really took place over a long period of time started in 2006 and then 2007 and then 2008. And as I look in the recent months at the debate over reauthorizing the FISA Amendments Act, oversight and transparency, to me, seem like the two main concerns that have been expressed by both some members of Congress as well as sort of the outside advocates and people who think about this. On the oversight piece, from my perspective, having been involved in this process, I think that the concerns on oversight are somewhat off base, and I'd be happy to talk, you know, in more detail about the types of oversight mechanisms, both internal to the executive branch and in all three branches of government that were built into the act and that are in place.
Well, let me throw out a for instance that might kind of narrow that down a bit. Say, and this is me speaking naively as someone who does not know exactly what information is going where in the files of the federal government. Say you're doing some kind of surveillance, sweeping, just doing a dragnet, just trawling the whole floor of the internet, and my information gets caught up in that. For whatever reason, you intercept some email that I sent from a personal account to a friend with a link of something I saw at work, and it is now part of a file that lives with the National Security Agency about some terror investigation. How do I know that I am not going to become part of an investigation, that my name is not now on some kind of a list associated with some overseas bad guys? How am I protected from that?
Okay, so I'm going to answer your question, but I'm first going to challenge your hypothetical, because
okay.
I would reject the notion of the overall dragnet. The FISA Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, sort of the two basic provisions: the old provision where an individual is targeted based on probable cause. That always contemplated, that portion of the statute, the old portion of the statute, always contemplated that there would be incidental collection. In other words, persons' communications who may not have been the original target would be collected in some way. That does not mean that there would have been some dragnet. It just means that they would have been in communication somehow, and somehow their communications would be collected. Those communications would be handled through what are called minimization procedures. And what that term means, it's defined in the statute, and what it basically means is procedures to handle Americans' information. And so those procedures are actually classified, but there are protective procedures that are approved by the Attorney General and approved by the FISA court to handle that information. So fast forward into acquisition that occurs under the FISA Amendments Act. Now, that would be a circumstance where the intelligence community is targeting a non-U.S. person outside the United States. There still, incidentally, could be a collection. So this gets to your question.
Mm-hmm.
Could be a collection, incidentally, of an American's communication, or just sort of a person not involved in any terrorism-related activity. Those minimization procedures still apply. There, and those procedures, again, are approved by the court, approved by the Attorney General before that. Those procedures are transparent to the intelligence committees. So members of Congress who have the appropriate clearances on the intelligence committees have seen those procedures and know what they are. And so that's how incidental collection of Americans' information is handled.
Now, some of those members of Congress include California Senator Dianne Feinstein, who is a ranking member on the Senate Intelligence Committee. She was among the people who was very, very supportive of the FISA Amendments Act, saying this was an essential tool for us being able to continue our foreign surveillance. But Lee Tien, I saw him just shaking his head as you explained this, because Lee, I think you kind of pulled out when she said it was transparent to the intelligence community. That's kind of like saying it's opaque.
Well, it's a lot like saying it's opaque.
Sort
it's
of,
a lot
yeah.
like saying it's secret. I mean, this raises so many issues, it's impossible to get into all of them. But I mean, at a high level, I think one way to think about this is that the government is looking for a very, very tight kind of executive oversight, a lot of internal oversight, a lot of chummy inside secret rooms kind of oversight. And so what we're hearing Professor Cordero say is that, well, you know, don't worry, a secret court has approved this. The, you know, there are classified procedures and they're just fine. You know, I would say, you know, well, let's look first at the way that Section 702 works. I mean, it creates this first of all, this system that is a program or a bucket warrant, it's not individually based. And so they're saying, yeah, we're going to just look and grab a lot of communications without any kind of individualized authorization. And second, the way that it's done under the statute is it's broken up. The FISA court has no idea who it is that's being actually being targeted. The FISA court's only reviewing the procedures as procedures. Once they get this authority, then the government turns around and goes to providers and just tells them, hey, we've got this. Now you just start collecting. And this is the context in which Senator Wyden and others have said, well, wait a minute. You know, you've got these giant sort of buckets of communications. We know that what Professor Cordero calls incidental is really, you know, the two sides of, say, a conversation or an email exchange. It is incidental in one sense, but it is completely inevitable in the other. And so you have a lot of communications, and the questions are like, well, how long are they kept? How many are there? What is the government doing with them? And the important part about what happened this summer with Senator Wyden is that he got the Office of Director of National Intelligence to admit publicly, mm-hmm. you know, two things. One, that the FISA court at least once had found that these procedures were being used in a way that was unreasonable and therefore violated the Fourth Amendment. And second, that at least once the FISA court had actually stated that what the government was doing, and we don't know what that was, violated the spirit of the statute.
We're coming up on the break for this hour, the halfway point for this hour. We want to continue this conversation, including some of your calls and emails at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. We're discussing the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the use of warrantless wiretapping in the United States with Lee Tien, the senior staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and Kerry Cordero, the director of National Security Studies at the Georgetown University Law Center. Let's bring in one call before we go to our break at the bottom of the hour from Ken in San Francisco. Ken, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I recall the EFF suing the government in 2003 or 2004. There was at the AT&T switching office right in Folsom Street in San Francisco. The NSA had installed a secret room to split off or capture all our internet traffic. And I guess I mean millions of communications all throughout the United States. This was a hub, and the NSA, as people should know, is not charged with surveilling domestically. Can't track Americans yet.
Right.
Here they were, and I guess they got immunity, and Feinstein was involved in that also. So I'm wondering, if I sent you an email now saying, hey, can you talk about the bombing in Yemen, is someone looking for that keyword in my email wondering, am I a threat because I used the word bombing?
Ken, that's a good question.
How does this relate to today?
That's a good question. Let me put that to Professor Cordero to see if that was written into the intent of the law. We're almost up to a break, Professor, but can you answer that briefly?
Sure. So the 702 provisions, which is the FISA Amendments Act provisions, still needs to be targeting, even though it's under a certification that gets approved by the court, there still needs to be a target by the intelligence community of a for foreign intelligence person of a person outside the United States. So people, and there are limitations in the statute specifically prohibiting the intentional targeting of persons who are here in the United States, as well as prohibiting the collection of purely domestic communication.
Let me let Lee Tien on that briefly before we hit the break.
Right. I think that I would agree with Professor Cordero. The 702 section is not the problem there. That problem is the warrantless wiretapping program that we originally sued the NSA and AT&T about.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll continue to take your calls and emails about warrantless wiretapping and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, recently amended and signed into law by President Obama. The 5-year extension was signed into law. Give us a call, 866-733-6786. Email us, forum@kqed.org. I'm Joshua Johnson. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. I'm Joshua Johnson from KQED News, sitting in for Michael Krasny. We're discussing the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, recently amended and extended by President Obama. Having that conversation with Lee Tien, the senior staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, based here in San Francisco, and Kerry Cordero, the director of National Security Studies at the Georgetown University Law Center. Let me go to a few emails. We do welcome your questions and thoughts. Give us a call, 866-733-6786. The lines are wide open, 866-733-6786, or email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. Bruce writes on our webpage, "The things that really contribute to our safety are those that promote more openness. We need to be admitting more students from Middle Eastern countries, and more of our young people need to travel and study in the region. Sure, there is risk, but it is far less risky than military and surveillance solutions," quote unquote. "It was increasing openness that brought down the Iron Curtain. The universal surveillance of East Germany was a failed policy. Why would we want to mimic the policies that lead to the fall of that led to the fall of that government? I speak from the perspective of studying abroad and Peace Corps service." Thanks for the comment, Bruce. Let me put that to you, Professor Cordero. The idea of openness versus security. I know that the idea partly with FISA is to open a secure door for the federal government to have certain surveillance. But isn't there something to be said for more openness?
Absolutely. And to the extent that there has been a debate over the last few months over the FISA Amendments Act, transparency really, in addition to oversight, transparency really was sort of the second main theme. And I think it's a much more, on the oversight, as I mentioned, you know, I think there is sort of a significant amount. But the transparency piece really is quite nuanced. There were proposals to provide, and there is a desire on the part of some members of Congress and others who sort of are interested in this area to enable more of the deliberations between the FISA court to be made public. There actually was some internal government change movement on this issue in the 2009-2010 timeframe, where the executive branch set up a process to try to be more accommodating and try to set up a process whereby certain opinions could be declassified. These are opinions of the FISA court. As Senator Wyden noted sort of over the last few months, none have been declassified according to that process yet. There was a provision also included in the recent amendments in 2008 where summaries of the legal opinions made by the FISA court are provided to the intelligence committees. But I think what some members and certainly members of the public and the advocacy community would prefer to see is to have more of that information public. The arguments for declassifying are sort of along the lines of what Mr. Tan was saying earlier, that it's not good to have a secret body of law, and that a more informed citizenry would benefit from that. But the arguments against it are that the legal analysis for matters that go before the FISA court are so intertwined with the operational facts that it really is a very difficult thing to do in practice.
It might be hard to actually just black out enough of the sensitive information so that you could release it without releasing something that's genuinely secret information.
And so that it would actually be a meaningful release. So to contrast that, there is an appellate-level court of the FISA Court of Review called the FISA it's called the FISA Court of Review, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court of Review. And that court has met two times in history, once in 2002, once in 2000, made a decision that was released in 2008, and those opinions were declassified and released publicly. And so those were very significant interpretations of the FISA, and so those the government did go through the process, and they were written in a way where, because they were at the appellate level, they could be released publicly.
Let me put to Lee Tien from the Electronic Frontier Foundation kind of the mean ground-level question, which is, if the government should happen to get, and I know this is a mean question, but it has to be asked, if the government should happen to get a little of my information, hear one of my phone calls to a friend in London, get maybe one or two of my emails, and I know I'm not a terrorist, I know I'm not doing anything dangerous, I know I'm not a risk to the country, and I know that it's in support of keeping me safe from another terror attack, what's the real harm? If I never know and they never tell, and no one is tangibly aware of the affront that it causes, what's the big deal?
Well, I mean, I think that's kind of the wrong question. I mean, there are many, many ways that information about you can be used by people without your ever knowing about it that can cause harm to you.
Yeah, but Facebook is using my information all the time in ways I don't know. I mean,
a lot of people think that that's not good either.
Right, don't we have a slightly better interest in allowing the federal government to have a little bit more leeway in terms of being able to protect us from people who are killing us or wanting to kill us, rather than say, you know, Facebook, which is a whole brand new area of the law being written as we speak? Isn't there a little bit of an interest in we the people saying, you know what, we're going to give you a little rope on this to either hang yourself or swing to safety? Can't we give the government that leeway?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, it's sort of the problem is that we don't know what they're doing. And so the kind of bargain you're suggesting is one that assumes that, you know, there is some sort of limit and that there are you're sort of assuming the kinds of checks and balances, which I'm saying haven't existed for a while. When Professor Cordero talks about slight increases in transparency in 2010 timeframe, when we've been at the height of a great deal of overclassified secrecy since September 11th, and even today, and the idea that we're having nuanced transparency debates more than a decade after a highly secretive covert regime, that's really shown in strong incentives and interests in engaging in a great deal of surveillance. You don't know what they can be listening to or reading. And what we have been arguing is that at the very least, we need to have a good understanding of what it is that they are actually doing. What we have found is that even the very terms, the very language that the government uses in public to reassure people is indeed designed to obfuscate. One example, for instance, is that General Hayden, back in 2006, assured the American public that something like, you know, our program of surveillance is not a drift net over various American communities gathering conversations.
That's to my concern about, you know, being caught up in some digital dragnet.
Right. And then – but when he was questioned about this statement later on in during a hearing for confirmation, he said, well, you note that I was very, very careful to say conversations. I didn't say communications. So the negative pregnant of his original statement was a very, very clear – was a denial that they are, say, listening to phone calls, but a completely zero denial that they were capturing electronic mail and other kinds of text. And yet this is the sort of weasel language that the government's frequently using in an attempt to make people feel better about what's happening.
Speaking of listening to phone calls, let's listen to one right now. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking the call. It's a very interesting show.
Well, thank you. What's on your mind, Mark?
So I'm interested in one issue, and just very briefly, let me set the stage by saying this. I think most reasonable people would agree that there are entities in the world that really wish to do us harm and that probably can't be appeased and that really want to destroy us. And I think most reasonable people would also agree that we need to seek some means of protection against the desires of these entities. And I think most people would also agree that the right to free speech and the right to privacy, those rights are not absolute, and they're tempered for us every day in some ways. And, you know, most intelligence agencies would wish to have access to all data all the time, but that's not tenable. So the question that I'm interested in is how our judicial system weighs the need for a state's ability to defend itself and to protect itself, protect us, and the issues of privacy and the issue of our right to be able to say what we want. Is this an objective process? Or is this kind of like obscenity, I'll know it when I see it type of thing? Right. And I'll take my answer off the air. And thanks again for a very interesting show.
Oh, thank you for a good question, Mark. Let me put that to Kerry Cordero, and let me zero in on one part of Mark's question, which is all data all the time. Is there really a benefit to having – is more data better in terms of intelligence, or do you reach a certain point where it becomes just a glut of useless information?
Well, you know, and this is just sort of you know, my view based on my experience of working with intelligence professionals, I would probably disagree that the intelligence community wants all data all the time. I think there probably is a point where there could be too much information. In other words, they don't want to be overwhelmed by completely useless information. And so when we're talking about FISA, they're looking for, the intelligence community wants to find foreign intelligence information regarding national security threats. And so they don't want to just sort of know everything about everything. They do have limited resources and people whose job every day is to find foreign intelligence information and weed out the threats and then make useful use of that information. So I guess that's how I would sort of address that piece of it.
We're discussing warrantless wiretapping and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act with Kerry Cordero of the Georgetown University Law Center and Lee Tien of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We'd like to discuss it with you, too. Give us a call, 866-733-6786. Email us, forum@kqed.org. You can reach us on our Facebook page or send us a tweet. We are @KQED Forum. Lee, did you want to chime in on that?
Yeah, I wanted to respond a little bit to what Professor Cordero said. That because you have a sort of a fire hose problem in real time, but what we seem to be seeing from the government is a pattern in which they talk a lot about what they can't do in real time, but all the signs indicate that they're storing and retaining a great deal of information just in case. We have seen in particular this year the evolution of the National Counterterrorism Center database, and this was the subject of a remarkable story in the media, I think the Wall Street Journal, within the last month, talking about huge fights inside the administration about keeping data about American citizens longer and sucking in data from all of the various government databases. And one of the reasons why the rules for this changed so they would be keeping things for much, much longer than before was because there was this constant pressure within the administration to collect and analyze more data. And what we've seen over and over again is Congress, also often part of the problem, saying, well, why didn't you figure this out? Oh, and then the answer is, oh, well, in order to figure this out, we need more data. We're going to store more. We're going to run more computer programs, data mining on it. And so I would argue, I think, that while there are some operational issues that I'm sure they experience with overwhelming data, that there is a storage is cheap and that there are strong incentives within the intelligence community in order to actually gather more data.
Let's go back to the phones now. Charles in San Francisco. Charles, good morning.
Good morning, Joshua.
What's on your mind, Charles?
Okay. Well, I just want to preface just quickly. I look back at all the Republican administrations, during my adult life, and I look at Reagan, and I look at the Iran-Contra scandal, and to me that was criminal. And then we go to, a lot of these secret things going on with the Bush administrations, and here we go have Obama, and you mentioned earlier that the legislation or the bill was just passed to extend this wiretapping for another 5 years, and we seem to be on a flip-flop between the Democrat administration, then back to a Republican, then back to a Democrat, and going 5 years means we're going to be going into a new administration and possibly a Republican administration. And when's this going to end, When's this wiretapping? When's this collecting of information on people, on Ron Paul followers and Tea Party followers? When's it going to end?
Charles, that's a good question. Let me put that to Kerry Cordero. Actually, if I can modify it a little bit, Kerry, I wonder if we are ever going to have an administration that is, at least in the near term, as long as 9/11 is in the memories of people who are yet alive, going to roll that back. I mean, President Obama, before he was President Obama, when he was campaigning, campaigned against this. And now as president, he signed it into law. So, Professor Cordero, I wonder if what you see in terms of the political will in Washington to change tactics other than what Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon proposed and a few other amendments, there really isn't the political will to change this right now or in the near future, is there?
I don't think so. I mean, in terms of a political assessment, I don't think there is. I think what we saw in terms of the recent debate over the reauthorization was that there was a very limited debate, and I think partly that goes to the very robust debate that took place in the 2007-2008 timeframe and the bipartisan nature of that bill that was passed. I think that so much work and effort in informing members of Congress took place in 2007-2008, and the act passed in a bipartisan way, that when it came time for renewal now, coupled with sort of that informed version that the members had and the bipartisan support for it, there was not sort of a very significant opposition to it. The opposition really was sort of on some of the transparency measures. And sunsets, you know, sort of raise this issue as we go forward on the sunsets. I mean, the sunsets are intended to sort of bring the debate back up and enable members of Congress to be reinformed about it, but the farther and farther away that we get from the original authorization, there are intelligence operations that take place under these laws, and the farther and farther we get away, it would be very damaging to national security to reverse course operationally at this point.
Let's take a look at some of the emails that we've been getting. Please keep on sending us your thoughts. Forum@kqed.org. Joe writes, remember, the FBI declared many who took part in the Occupy movement were domestic terrorists. George writes, do FISA and the 2012 Defense Authorization Act, which allows the government to arrest American citizens and detain them indefinitely without charge, make the U.S. a police state? And Arthur asks specifically to you, Mr. Tien, how far have we in the U.S. traveled down the road to the Big Brother intrusive kind of society, which we used to criticize in the way the Soviet Union tracked and repressed their citizens? Please explain why U.S. citizens should be concerned about the surveillance allowed under FISA as amended now, and suggest what we as American citizens can do about it.
Well, to take the second question, the last question first, it's a little late to do anything about it right now because we had this show 2 or 3 weeks ago. I would be recommending that all of you contact your senators and ask them to vote to not reauthorize the FISA Amendment Act. A more general question is, yes, I think we are moving in the direction of we are already in a surveillance-laden society. It is, of course, the case that surveillance is not only by the government, not even predominantly necessarily by the government. It is by everyone who has access to our communications. There's a great number of ISPs and business interests, et cetera, that are constantly keeping track of what we do financially, you know, where we travel. We've, you know, had some a lot of recent debates over GPS tracking and various kinds of location tracking. It is sort of the nature of our technological society that much more is recorded about us. The real question is, do we have the political will to actually say, well, wait a minute, all of the surveillance that's going on isn't really necessary. We don't need to have this much in order to have the security that we want. But this takes us back to the kind of debate that we are half having. We are half having it because we are talking about whether we should continue these laws. But it is only half a debate because we are still not being told what is being done under these laws, how much of our privacy is actually being violated, and we don't even know what the law means. Without that kind of information, you can't make, in a democratic society, a a good choice.
And I wonder if, you know, in the current political climate, I know there are plenty of people like EFF and other organizations who are really fired up about this. And for reasonable reasons, you know, if there's data, if our information is flowing around, it's wise to know where it's going. But, you know, in a political environment where everyone is upset about jobs, to talk about Fourth Amendment, unlawful search and seizure, you know, domestic wiretapping, eyes glaze over really, really fast when you start talking to the American people as a whole and trying to kind of build some kind of national political energy about this. Let's go back to the phones, 866-733-6786. John, good morning.
Good morning. The truth of the matter is that the average citizen, myself included, we don't trust the government. We have seen so many abuses over so many years of the government abusing its power, lying to us about it. And then when they're confronted with a real investigation, for instance, the 9/11 investigation, before it happened, the FBI erred on all points, on all investigations in New Mexico and Minnesota. They just didn't put it together. Now, all of a sudden, they're becoming efficient on watching us. It doesn't make any sense to me. Why should we let them have this power, you know, to make our lives more difficult?
John, thanks for your call. Kerry Cordero, it seems like no matter how much work you try to do, this seems like one of those areas of the law where you will always have the American people just not really believing, not really trusting. It's like once you catch someone, the system is perfectly validated. But until that moment, there's always going to be distrust.
Well, I think a healthy skepticism is always a good thing, actually. It does raise the question. The questioner's comment raises a question, as well as sort of some of our earlier discussion, though, about what the country believes is the appropriate role of the intelligence committees in Congress. And so in some of the recent debate regarding the transparency issues, what's important to note is that the intelligence committees actually do receive a lot of information. And so this is, of course, our representatives in government in a different branch, in the legislative branch. These members on the intelligence committees receive many, many reports regarding the activities that occur under the FISA and the FISA Amendments Act. Intelligence reports, they receive briefings, their staff receives briefings, they receive notice of any compliance incidents that may occur, they receive a discussion of findings of the FISA court, and so a lot of information goes to the intelligence committees.
Right.
I think what's interesting is concerns expressed by members of Congress and of the public that still doesn't seem to be of comfort. So it's not even just the executive branch that does oversight, but there is congressional oversight, and yet that piece doesn't always seem to provide the comfort that those committees were intended to provide.
Lee Tien, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I agree completely. I mean, I think the Gang of Eight system, the Select Intelligence Committee system, is part of the problem, not part of the solution. I mean, you know, this is not the way we handle other issues. We wouldn't consider this proper accountability for most other things. And while we gave this a shot over the years, I think what we've seen since 9/11 is that in this kind of time, the intelligence committees don't adequately function as a check. I mean, when I remember reading about Senator Rockefeller's sort of secret letter, he wrote a letter the first time he was briefed on one of the major surveillance programs, and he couldn't take it out of the room, and he left it in the Senate Intelligence Committee room, I think. And, you know, he said, I just heard this really scary briefing. I don't understand what they're talking about. I don't understand the technology, but I also therefore don't know enough to say that they shouldn't do it. I think that I'm not going to make him out to be a hero or one thing or the other, but I think you have a serious problem when the only people the Intelligence Committee is hearing from is from the executive branch, which is pushing, selling, trying to persuade them in the first place to do this. And there is no way that those members can get out and get other opinions, it is a serious sort of ex parte problem, as we lawyers call it.
Let's take a few more calls before our time is up. Brandon in Santa Clara, briefly, good morning.
Good morning.
What's on your mind, Brandon?
There's a project in the NSA referred to as Stellar Wind that's been reported by the New York Times and Newsweek, and I wanted to know, is that related to FISA? Is it authorized by FISA? And is it considered constitutional or not? And also, what are the details from what the articles say that it records blanket communications for Americans regardless of relation to foreign terrorism?
All right. Thanks, Brandon. Carrie Cordero, do you know anything about that?
I don't have any comment on that specific question. What I would say is that the FISA Amendments Act was intended to replace activities that were previously described as the president's terrorist surveillance program. And so that was sort of the new regime that was implemented as a result of those acts and was just reauthorized.
Let's go to another call from Jenna in San Francisco. Jenna, good morning.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. What's on your mind?
During the Bush years, any time that I sent an email out of the country expressing disapproval with the Bush policies, my friends or relatives did not receive it. And I began to test it by sending out an email expressing disapproval and then calling them. And any email that was sent out didn't get through.
Really? And you sent this through a mainstream internet service provider, I'm assuming.
Right, exactly.
And I'm guessing that your concern about this is that it was, what, intercepted or?
Yes, my concern is that it was intercepted. Evidently, it was intercepted as my friends and relatives did not get any of these emails.
Wow, that's I've never heard of anything. Oh, go ahead, Jenna.
Yeah, and I'm just a regular person. No terrorist threat involved at all, just expressing discontent.
I've never heard anything like that before. But Jenna, thank you for sharing that. Thank you very much. I know our time is almost up. Li Tien, any brief thoughts about where you see this fight going from here? I know you said it's already been re-upped for 5 years, so are we kind of in a holding pattern now?
Well, we're going to, you know, there's a lot that can be done. I mean, obviously, right now we are still litigating our case against the National Security Agency, Juul versus NSA, over warrantless wiretapping. That's one where we're really, in a way, we're doing a great deal of impact litigation on the state secrets privilege, which is one of the doctrines that the government relies on to avoid telling the public what it's actually doing. There's also a lot of activity that we're expecting to happen in the legislature and also Freedom of Information Act requests. We've got lawsuits, again, trying to find out what kinds of secret law interpretations are being used by the government in order to conduct surveillance.
Well, we'll certainly keep an eye on this issue as the next 5 years go on. Li Tien is the senior staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation in San Francisco. Li, I appreciate your time. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you.
And also Carrie Cordero, the director of National Security Studies at the Georgetown University Law Center. Professor Cordero, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Thank you so much for listening. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.